Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program features KKFI's own John Kerman, and he's going to talk about why climate matters most and why we need you. This program was recorded on Sunday, January the 11th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We'll have a short introduction from Rita Norton, and then we'll go right to Mr. Kerman.
Good morning. I'm Rita Norton, a member of the forum committee that organizes these platforms for the discussion of significant issues. John Kerman is familiar to the UU Forum and to All Souls Services as well. He is a community activist and lead coordinator for 350KC, the local affiliate for 350.org, the global grassroots climate movement organization responsible for making sure that millions of people know about climate change. John.
Your turn.
Thank you, Rita. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out on this frigid morning. It being frigid actually makes it a little bit harder, research shows, for me to convince you that global warming is a real problem. Studies have shown that if you're in a room and they raise the temperature, people become more inclined to believe global warming is a real problem than if they're in a room where the temperature is cool. Interesting how we're affected subconsciously by things. So my point this morning, my purpose for being here this morning, is to convince you that global warming and climate disruption should be the progressive imperative, the absolute most important thing we are working on. Now, because I've been misunderstood on this point when I've given this talk in other forums, let me stress something very, very important. Because I'm saying it is the progressive imperative, the absolute most important thing for us to be working on, does not mean I'm saying nothing else matters. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be working on anything else. I'm sure many of you, maybe all of you in this room, are already passionate about at least one and probably several other of the many, many problems we face, both here in the United States and globally. All of those things still matter, but I hope to convince you this morning that if we don't deal with the climate crisis, anything else we accomplish is going to be wiped away, any other progress we make on the other issues that face us. And that's because there are some very important things that most people don't understand about the climate crisis. Now, the first one of those is that carbon pollution is not like other pollution. It's not what most people think of as far as pollution in the way that it behaves. If you're putting other air pollutants out from your car, from a smokestack, from burning a fire, if you stop doing those things, the problem will clear up very quickly. It doesn't linger that long. So we've seen this, a recent example of this is when something big international event is happening in one of China's terribly polluted cities, like the Olympics, they'll make everybody stop driving, they'll shut down factories before it happens, and the air will clear very, very quickly once those activities have stopped. Then you go back to doing it, and the air is very quickly polluted again. And the same is true with what most other people perceive of as pollution, the sort of problems that you can see, that you can smell, that are very immediate. This, of course, is one of the problems with carbon pollution, is that you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it. If we could, it would be clear that we had a problem, because we'd see the amount of carbon dioxide that's always in the atmosphere around us increasing. But we can't see it. Now, the first thing that most people don't understand about climate is there is what is called the climate lag. So the carbon dioxide that all of us in this room are emitting by driving here this morning, by turning on electricity, by all of these things that we're doing, we won't feel the effects of in warming fully for somewhere in the range of 30 to 50 years. And that's because of the thermal inertia of the oceans. It takes a long time for the oceans to warm up because they're so vast. So there's this lag between what we emit and when the effects are felt. So even if we completely stopped emitting carbon dioxide, right this very moment, worldwide, the world will continue to warm up for as much as 50 more years into the future. Scientists don't understand the climate dynamics quite well enough to say exactly how long, but it could be as much as 50 years into the future, even if we stop all the carbon emissions that we're putting out right this very second. Now, there's another problem that people don't understand about climate, is that once carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, unlike those other air pollutants, it doesn't go away. It stays for a very long time. So the carbon dioxide that we emit today that I was talking about, some of that will still be in the air thousands of years in the future. It is slowly taken back out of the atmosphere by various natural processes, but it happens over a very long time. So say we did stop emitting all carbon dioxide today, everywhere in the world, no net carbon emissions to the atmosphere. So the world would continue to warm for up to 50 years, and it would continue to be at that overheated state for hundreds to thousands of years into the future. Because for the same reason that it takes a while for the world to warm up in response to emissions today, it takes a long time for it to cool back down. What this means is that the climate is like a bathtub with a fast faucet and a slow drain. So say you have your bathtub with a faucet cranked all the way up, but you have a really slow drain. It's constantly draining, but it's draining much more slowly than what's coming in from the faucet. And the climate works the same way. The carbon dioxide is constantly being taken back out of the atmosphere. But we're pumping it out in such volumes that it is building up and building up and building up. And with that slow drain, it will continue to take a very long time for it to work back out. It will eventually, but for our purposes, within the timescale not only of human lives, but of global civilization, it might as well be there forever. The consequences will be as if it's there forever for our purposes, because they will be so drastic and over a much shorter time frame. What this means, in essence, is that global warming is not reversible. We can't stop it, although we can stop how much there will be. And it means we can't turn it back. Most Americans don't understand this. I think they assume that it's like these other sorts of problems we've had, like the bad smog we had in our cities back in the 60s and 70s. Well, we implemented the Clean Air Act and all of these pollution control measures, and the air did get cleaner. But we have no real way to do that with the climate crisis. Yes, regenerative agriculture, instead of the industrial agriculture we have now, would take some carbon dioxide, a substantial amount, back out and store it as carbon in the soil. And plant growth, if we planted more trees, that would take a significant amount of carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere and store it in the trees. But we have no method, and they're working on technological methods to try to take carbon out of the atmosphere and safely sequester it, but we have no way to deal with the vast amounts of carbon dioxide that we have already emitted and take that back out of the atmosphere. It is simply not a reversible problem. Now, wait, it gets worse. There are also what scientists have called tipping points, climate tipping points that have been identified. I don't have time to go through all the different ones that have been identified, but I'm going to give you some of the high points here. And what I mean by a tipping point is where a change that we have caused by emitting carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and warming the planet triggers other changes that produce yet more warming or yet additional problems that are out of our control that we didn't directly cause but that were caused by our emissions. And what you can get with that is a reinforcing feedback loop. So we've warmed the planet X amount directly by the emissions, and then that triggers these changes which cause more warming, and what you can get is this reinforcing feedback loop and the possibility, if we keep going the way we're going, of what's called a runaway greenhouse effect. All right, so let's talk about a few of those tipping points. One is the Arctic sea ice. So Arctic sea ice has already been diminishing. And there are predictions that within just a matter of a few years, possibly, but certainly within my lifetime, The Arctic will be ice-free in summer. Now, why does that matter? Now, that's happening because of the warming that we've already caused. The Arctic is warming more quickly than the mid-latitudes of the planet. Now, why does that matter? That matters because sea ice is light in color and reflects sunlight back into space. The underlying water is dark in color and absorbs heat coming from the sun. So with the ice gone, more heat is absorbed and retained on the planet, adding to the warming. The same factor occurs with the melting of the world's glaciers, the mountain glaciers of the world. When those melt, the darker land underneath absorbs more of the sun's heat and retains it, increasing warming. We have the same issue with the Tibetan Plateau. Frozen over, reflective now, but as it melts, as it's predicted to melt, again, the darker ground underneath will absorb more heat. Now, those all have to do with what's called the albedo effect, this reflective effect of the light-colored ice and snow. But there are other effects that we have to worry about, too. One is the melting of the Arctic permafrost, which has been frozen year-round. As that melts, it begins to decompose, and you get the release of carbon dioxide, which is bad enough, but also methane, which is a much more potent heat-trapping gas than carbon dioxide is. Over a 20-year time span, methane traps 86 times as much heat as carbon dioxide does. And then when it breaks down, it still leaves carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which will continue to trap heat. Another issue is the drying of the Amazon. So what the models show us is that as the climate is disruption, rainfall patterns over the Amazon will change, it will begin to dry out, it will become more prone to fire, and of course when you have a forest burn, the carbon that was in the trees and all the other vegetation is released to the atmosphere, as well as carbon in the soil. So another reinforcing feedback loop. And then the really big scary one when it comes to warming we cause triggering further warming are what are called the methane clathrates or hydrates, which are frozen under sediments on the ocean floor. These are deposits of methane, which again is 86 times more potent a heat-trapping gas than carbon dioxide. Massive deposits of them frozen under the sediment of the ocean floor. Should those melt and that methane be released in what have been colloquially referred to as methane burps, the catastrophic warming effect would be beyond our comprehension. Now, those are tipping points when it comes to our warming triggering additional warming. But there's also tipping points when it comes to sea level rise. So as the sea warms, as the water in the seas themselves warm, they expand. Thermal expansion of the oceans, warming water expands. But as our warming causes the melting of ice on land in Greenland and in Antarctica, that water melts and runs off into the oceans. Now, when floating sea ice melts, it doesn't add to the level of the oceans because it's already in the water. But when ice on land melts, and it runs off into the ocean. That, of course, does add to the sea level rise. And the report, I think the studies came out last May, said that the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet is irreversible. It is going to happen. If that all were to melt and go into the ocean, that would raise sea level something on the order of 13 feet, which would be catastrophic. Then, this isn't exactly a tipping point, but it is another aspect of the climate crisis that's irreversible for us, that we have no way to reverse, is ocean acidification. So when we release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it doesn't all stay in the atmosphere. A very substantial portion of it ends up in the oceans. It gets absorbed into the ocean in the form of carbonic acid. And what that does is it changes the pH of the oceans, causing them to acidify. Their oceans are already 30% more acidic than they were before the Industrial Revolution. Now, what does that matter? So the acidification of the oceans makes it more increasingly difficult for organisms at the core of the food web, these tiny organisms that provide the core of the food web that the larger organisms feed on, that then are fed on by other organisms, and on and on and on, making the entire marine food web possible. The acidifying oceans make it harder and harder for them to form shells. If they can't form shells, they can't live. You destroy, or even just significantly undermine, the core of the food web, the entire web begins to break apart over time. And we are increasing to acidify the oceans. Now, I don't know how much fish all of you eat, ocean fish all of you eat. I don't eat a lot because I don't live anywhere close to an ocean. But it provides a very substantial portion of the world's food supply. So the marine food web breaking apart would have devastating consequences for the worldwide food supply, which is, it's hard to say which is the scariest consequence of global warming and climate disruption we face. We face devastating problems with drought that will affect food supply, with floods that will affect food supply, with rising sea levels that will affect food supply, with this ocean acidification. And then there's the problems as the sea levels rise. Small island nations are already facing the prospect of ceasing to exist because they are literally submerged. Where do those people go? But that's just the beginning. If the sea levels rise, the kinds of up to 15 or 20 feet that we're talking about, that wipes out huge areas of the world's coastlines and means hundreds of millions of people have to go somewhere. Where do they go? And how do we deal with the consequences of resettling them? I mean, these are things that, if left to go on the way they're going, will catastrophically devastate the global economy and therefore global civilization. And we can't wait for the reasons I described at the beginning. The long time lag from when emissions go into the atmosphere to when the full effects of them are felt in warming. The long residence time of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, how long it stays there, and these global warming tipping points, we can't wait indefinitely to act on it. I think the average American thinks, well, when the scientists are really sure that it's happening, then we can change and we'll be able to solve it. No, that's not the way it works. One, the scientists are really sure, whatever the propaganda tells you. Two, when it becomes so devastating, when the severe weather effects become so devastating that the average person has no doubt whatsoever in their minds, because things are just so wonky, so strange, it'll be too late to avert catastrophic climate disruption. We can't wait for that. So that's the reasons why climate matters most. Now we get to the other part of my talk, which is the why we need you part. Now, if you watched An Inconvenient Truth, when did that come out? 2007, I think, Al Gore's big movie that made a big splash when it came out and got a lot of attention. Or most things you look at that talk about global warming, when they get to the what to do section, it's usually a list of things like change your light bulbs and eat less meat and try to use transit and bicycle and walk and remember to turn off the lights. Don't forget to turn off the lights. Now, don't get me wrong. Those are all wonderful things. They're good things. They're things you should do. There are things that I, most of them anyway, do. But those are not the kinds of things that are going to make the difference, except for the difference they make in terms of social change. It's not so much the direct effects of those kinds of personal, individual lifestyle choices that matter. It's the effect that you doing them and the people in your circle of acquaintance and family and friends seeing you do them has the effect. Because if they see that you are taking it seriously, then they're more likely to take it seriously. But individual, personal lifestyle choices cannot solve this problem. We didn't create it by individual choices. We created it collectively with this whole way of life that we have. And so the only things that will be up to the task of solving the problem will also have to be collective actions. Now, That brings us to the question of how do we get collective actions? How do we mobilize to do that? The first book written for a general lay audience on global warming and climate disruption was written by Bill McKibben. It was called The End of Nature. I imagine several of you at least have read that book. It came out in 1988, if I remember right. And that was the same year that James Hansen, the most renowned climate scientist in the world, and the one who, with his colleagues, came to the conclusion that the safe upper limit of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is 350 parts per million, which is where the 350.org name comes from, testified before the Senate about global warming. So we've been talking about this since 88 in a very public way, and yet you may have noticed that very little action has taken place. And in last November's elections, we managed to elect Republican majorities in both the House, which already had a Republican majority, and the Senate. And the average Republican not only is not prepared to take serious, ambitious, and bold collective action to deal with the climate crisis, they question whether it exists at all. What do you do in the face of obstacles like that if you accept what I've laid out to you at the beginning about how serious this problem is and it being the progressive imperative? What we need to deal with this issue is, it's hard to find, because it is such a huge scale that affects so many aspects of our life, it's hard to find a precedent for the kind of action that we need. The closest precedent we have, and perhaps there are a few people in this room old enough to remember what it was like, is the mobilization that occurred after the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. A wartime mobilization. That provides a certain model, except it has to be much bigger and global and much more fundamental, because energy underlies everything we do. And it's the way we get and use energy that is causing this problem at the in the biggest portion of it. So we need a mobilization on that scale, a wartime mobilization, if you might look at it, although there's not exactly an enemy. Here's another reason why this gets complicated, is because we can't say those guys are the problem. We have to beat them, because we are all contributing to this, whether we want to or not. So that alone is an obstacle to people accepting this problem as real, because to accept that it's real is to accept that I'm contributing to it. I am destroying the future by my actions today. Which, you know, people understandably don't want to believe that's true. So how do we get to that kind of mobilization I'm talking about? It seems to me that the only chance we have is to build a grassroots global climate action movement for social change, and social change that is directed on transforming our energy system to a clean energy system and transforming our way of life so that clean energy can provide the energy we need. Because I got news for you, clean energy is not going to let us maintain our car culture that we have here in the United States. Ain't going to happen, folks. It's not going to allow us to have the globe-trotting travel we have in the United States in airplanes. That's not going to happen. We're not going to have electric-powered airplanes that run on renewable energy. That doesn't mean there won't be any travel. It just means it's not going to be the same way that it is now by any stretch of the imagination. So we're going to have to live in smaller houses, live more compact lives, closer to the places where we go, use transit, actually use these things we evolved for locomotion a lot more than we currently do now. So we have to build a movement, and we have models for how movements are built. The civil rights movement, the women's suffrage movement, the movement for LGBT marriage equality. We have examples of how, or the abolition movement, we have examples of how movements have changed in fundamental ways, although I would argue not as fundamental as the change we need here, but have changed society in fundamental ways in the past. Now, the first thing we need to understand, and this may be difficult for a free-thinking, all-souls primarily audience here, is that while making a reasonable, factual case is necessary, it is far from sufficient. What moves people to change in dramatic, fundamental ways is emotion. You have to get people in the heart in order to get them moving. And what are the fundamental emotions that fuel social change movements that get people up off their couches and out into the streets saying it's time to change. This may make people in the room uncomfortable as well, because my impression, at least, is that All Souls people are generally very calm and reasonable and reserved, even, I would say, and intellectual. It's outrage. It is anger. The civil rights movement, when those people went out into the streets, they didn't go out there calmly. I mean, they it's hard to speak of it as a single thing. But they were angry. They said, enough. And they didn't know they would win, but they weren't willing to stand by any longer. And believe me, we don't know that we will win in this case either. Frankly, it could already be too late. We don't understand enough about the climate and how it's going to be impacted by the emissions we've already put out to say for sure. But it's never too late to make things better than they otherwise will be. I know it may not be the most inspiring rallying cry, but it is the truth, and perhaps a whole lot better than things otherwise will be. So we have to reach people in their hearts. Now, global warming and the climate crisis are by their natures what are called wicked problems that are intrinsically complicated and difficult to solve, because we can't see the problem. As I said, you can't see carbon dioxide. We're all involved in creating the problem. The worst consequences won't be felt decades or even centuries out into the future. With sea level rise, we're talking centuries out into the future, the worst consequences will be felt. So it's not in our faces. But what we have to work toward is our own cultural tipping point to counteract those climate tipping points that I talked about earlier. Social change is an interesting thing. And I don't think most people think about it very much, but having been an activist for more than 20 years now, I've thought about it a lot. And the interesting thing about social change, and what most people assume about social change, is that it happens slowly, which is true up to a point. The way social change works is it happens slowly until it happens fast. So when a social change succeeds, it moves slowly through society at first, but then it reaches what is called a tipping point, or critical mass is another term that's used, at which point enough people have accepted and are ready for change that it flips and it goes from spreading slowly through society to spreading very quickly through society. Now, we have an excellent current example right now with the marriage equality movement. Now, if you've only just started paying attention, you'll think, wow, where'd all this come from? Suddenly all these states, these courts are ruling that two men and two women should have the same right to marry as a man and a woman do. And so that's like, well, where'd that come from? But if you were there at Stonewall back in 60 whatever it was, I don't remember right now, when this movement for LGBT equality was getting started, it doesn't seem quickly. It proceeded very slowly, and of course, after marriage equality, there are other fights to be won in that struggle, to be sure, but it proceeded very slowly for decades before it got to this point where suddenly now it's proceeding very quickly across the country. And we may be starting to see that with the legalization of marijuana use, we've certainly seen that women's suffrage. Now, to get to that tipping point fundamentally comes down to changing people's minds, changing the way people think. And that happens one person at a time. Everybody in this room has a circle of influence and therefore has the capacity to influence, and in fact you do influence, whether you're doing it consciously or not, how other people think and what other people think. So this is an area in which you can get involved and begin changing minds of people around you. And hopefully passing on what I told you at the beginning about what most people don't understand about this climate crisis. This is at heart a religious question, because it goes to who we are as a people and what our place is as part of the world. Now, neither one of those questions necessarily has to be answered with a supernatural answer, because I'm sure we have many people in here that don't believe in one particular religious conception of the supernatural or another. But those are fundamentally religious questions. So you don't have to say God created us and this was our purpose. But understanding what our purpose is and what our place is a fundamentally religious question. Now, what do we do in order to build a movement? So, like I said, climate is a wicked problem because of its amorphous nature and the way the time lag and all of those things. So the brilliance of the folks with 350.org at the national level, I can take zero credit for this, was that they, when James Hansen, again, the climate scientist who spoke back before the Senate in 88, came out and said in relation to the Keystone XL pipeline that if we fully exploit the tar sands to make oil, it will be game over for the climate. They saw that Keystone XL pipeline could be a fundamental focal point and rallying point to get people energized and build this movement that we're talking about, because it gave us something to focus on that was visible. I mean, if you've seen any of the photos of what they do to the old-growth Canadian boreal forest there in order to get this tar sands out, they're horrifying. And the waste ponds from these places and the spills that have occurred from other pipelines, I mean, this stuff is horrifying stuff. It's dirty, filthy stuff. So it gives us consequences that are already happening that we can make visible to people in connection with this bigger problem that's ultimately much more important, but it puts a face, and especially the faces of the people who are living in the path of this pipeline, who are living in the area in Canada, the indigenous nations who are native to the area in Canada where the tar sands are being dug up. So these kinds of strategically picked fights, literally picking fights, are essential to building the movement. So we have the fight over the Keystone XL pipeline, which just suddenly got a whole lot more interesting. I don't have time to talk about that in detail. But the fights to shut down existing coal plants and shut down or prevent the construction of new coal plants, the efforts to ban fracking, which has its own problems, pledges of civil resistance and actions of civil resistance where people are willing to get arrested opposing Keystone XL and refineries and fracking, which is happening all across the country, including Rita's own action in Washington, D.C. in 2011. All of these things are important. Those, of course, are all defensive. And while they are valuable for building a movement, they cannot solve the crisis. We can't win this fight by opposing individual pipelines and individual power plants and even individual methods of energy extraction like fracking or the tar sands. We have to go bigger than that. But they help us build a movement in a way that will allow us to go bigger. They give us the strength, the political strength, to go bigger with the kinds of big systemic changes like a price on carbon, probably most fundamentally, but also massive wartime scale investments in clean energy infrastructure and all those sorts of things. They give us the strength to push for those policies. But also while we're building the movement, we go on offense through such things as the Go Fossil Free Divestment Campaign, calling on institutions like churches and municipalities and universities to divest from the top 200 fossil fuel companies, to say, if it's wrong to wreck the climate, then it's wrong to profit from wrecking the climate. Now, the point of the divestment campaign is not that we're going to strike a crushing financial blow against the oil and gas and coal companies. The point is to change public understanding of these companies and make it clear to everyone that these are rogue companies, that if they are allowed to carry out their business model, simply carry out their business model, they will wreck one of the basic life support systems of the planet, and we should withdraw our support from them as much as is possible. And then another aspect of offense is trying to end fossil fuel subsidies. It's insane that not only are we allowed these, not only do we allow these companies to sell these products that are wrecking the climate without having to pay anything for doing it, but we subsidize them. Depending on exactly what you count as subsidies, there's in the range of $10 to $52 billion in subsidies a year in the U.S. alone, and $775 billion to $1 trillion globally. That's nuts. We're subsidizing the destruction of the world. Our governments, which means by extension us, are subsidizing the destruction of the world. Well, we don't have to do that. And we should stop. And I should stop soon. But first, because we need time for questions. So we need you to get involved. A movement needs bodies, needs people who are willing to get out and act. And to say no more. And again, I am not saying don't do anything else. Focus only on this with us. That's not what I'm saying. But give at least some of your time to getting out to the rallies, to the protests, to supporting the organizations that are doing this with your actual presence, not just dollars. And for those of you who feel like you can do it, who are retired, don't have to worry so much about having minor arrests on your records, be willing to engage in civil disobedience of various kinds. So, next thing is we have a rally this Tuesday evening calling on President Obama, now that the whole Nebraska Supreme Court issue is out of the way, to finally, once and for all, stick a stake through the heart of that damn Keystone XL. Wait a minute, I'm sure it doesn't have a heart. Pound a stake through that Keystone XL pipeline and put an end to it once and for all. That will be at 7 p.m. down in J.C. Nichols Park. Mill Creek Park, J.C. Nichols Fountain there by the, right down on the plaza at 7 p.m. Tuesday. I hope you'll come out for that. Sign up on our list so you know when we're having other actions, the 350KC list. There's more flyers out there. If you're interested in the possibility of civil disobedience, and in this case very minor civil disobedience, very peaceful civil disobedience, there is a Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance, which I am leading a local action for if our government looks like they're about to approve the thing. We'll only act if it looks like they're about to approve it. Please do contact your Congress critters and the President to tell them what you think. Sadly, not only does our Republican senator here in Missouri, plus both Republican senators in Kansas, support Keystone XL and have no interest whatsoever in taking bold climate action, but our dear Claire McCaskill is far from what we would like on this. She supports Keystone XL. She's wavering on the EPA's Clean Power Plan to cut emissions from coal-fired power plants and so on. I've given this talk at four different venues so far, including today, to various groups. If you know of a group where I could give this talk, please do. It's often said that when you give a talk like this, you're preaching to the choir because people who come out who already care. But my message is for the choir because I got news for you. Most of the choir is still sitting on their butts because I organize the events where I don't see them. And that will not solve this crisis. Finally, I cannot give you a lot of details about all of this in a 35 to 40 minute talk, but I highly recommend Naomi Klein's recent book, came out this past fall, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. We will not solve the climate crisis within the constraints of our current economic system. And with that, I will thank you all for coming out tonight. I hope I see you in the future at our events, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to John Kerman talk about climate change and why it matters and why it might be too late. We're going to take a short break. We're going to have a question and answer period from the audience in the second portion of our program today. But first, a few messages. We'll be right back to the All Souls Forum.
Democracy Now! Broadcast live from the Sundance Film Festival. Tune in all week from 8 until 9 a.m.
Robert McChesney talks about his new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, on Tell Somebody, Thursday morning at 9.
I want to talk with you mainly about our struggle in the United States, and before taking my seat, talk about some of the larger struggles in the whole world, and some of the more difficult struggles in places like South Africa.
Another chance to hear Martin Luther King's long-lost London speech of December 1964 on Sprouts Thursday at noon.
Tune in on Saturday afternoons for real local talk radio community programming starting at 3 o'clock p.m. Every Woman with Sharon Lockhart and Amy Bell, 4 o'clock p.m. Urban Connections with Donna Morrow Wolf, 5 o'clock p.m. Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with M.C. Richardson.
Are you aware that Senator McCaskill in recent days sent a survey to constituents in which she listed possible priorities for Congress and herself and did not list the environment in any way, shape, or form? And have you spoken to Senator McCaskill?
I haven't actually heard about that survey. I heard about another email she sent out to people who were on her list of her 14, I think it was, greatest accomplishments or things she's most proud of, something like that. I haven't read the email myself. For last year, and one of those was voting for the Keystone XL pipeline in November. That legislation thankfully did not pass, but I'm very disappointed to hear she cited that as one of her accomplishments. Actually getting a meeting with the senator is extremely difficult. You have to have a big money donor for that, basically, and we are not. We are trying to arrange a meeting with her staff, which is usually the best you can get. And of course, other groups. The Sierra Club met not too terribly long ago with her and the staff, and the staff member didn't seem like there was any chance she was going to be persuaded on Keystone XL. And I don't know how much progress they made on other issues, but we will continue to engage with her and try. But she needs to hear from as many constituents as possible too, because she can always say, "Well, you know, they're just a special interest." She needs to believe that there are enough of her constituents in order who support action for her spine to be sufficiently stiffened. I think she thinks I got to be a moderate in this state to continue to be elected. My take on that is she's never going to out-Republican whoever they run against her. And what she is going to do is sap the energy out of the base of people who made it possible for her to get elected in the first place. Yes.
While I take your point for the need for groundswell on social change, let's go back to your bathtub illustration.
Yes.
Most of us with a tub that does not have a fast enough drain would grab the Drano. Is there any scientific group that is working on the equivalent of Drano to allow the earth to reabsorb or stop sending off carbon dioxide, methane? What is being done on that frontier?
Yeah, as I mentioned briefly during my talk, there are studies showing that what's called regenerative agriculture, which is very similar to organic agriculture, not exactly the same thing, will help sequester carbon in the soil, take it back out of the atmosphere. Planting more trees would certainly do that. We could reforest a substantial part of the planet that's been deforested. And they are trying to figure out some technological processes that will do it. And those could help some. But again, they just simply, nothing is on the horizon. And I can't imagine what be. There's, what would be. We've just emitted so much to the atmosphere or put so much into the bathtub that there just are not ways to get enough of it back out to make a really substantial difference in this crisis. We won't be able to address it that way. And then there's the other side of it, where they're working on what is called geoengineering techniques, which would be efforts to absorb or to block some of the incoming sunlight, which would have all kinds of unwanted side effects if you start putting what are called sulfate particles into the stratosphere. They would block sunlight. It could work in that sense. It would reduce the level of sunlight coming in, but it would also have its own effects on climate and weather patterns and food production, and would be, as someone pointed out, the intelligent response to having inadvertently set in motion a vast, uncontrollable global experiment with the climate is not to intentionally start another vast, uncontrollable global experiment with the climate. So There are folks certainly talking about doing that. Most of the folks who are talking about doing it are only talking about doing it as a last resort. If we're at a point where it's just a huge crisis and we're faced with devastating consequences of runaway global warming, of throwing that stuff up there. But frankly, I think by then all will be lost if we let it get to that point. If. Always if.
25 years ago, I was teaching exactly the principles and correlations that you're talking about right now, using the same language and ideas. In that time, in the time since, there's really not much new come up. It's just new people coming in and out of the loop, trying to advance whatever their particular interest is. At that time, we were equally concerned with the fact that we were approaching 5 billion human organisms on the planet, and we were wondering where it was going to go, and now we're well over 7. But in the last 20 years, I have heard almost nothing about that in terms of global warming. And I was wondering, is there a connection? Are you seeing anybody looking at that as an issue that is that could possibly be impacted by intentional activity on the part of us?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's tough to be able to cover everything you want to cover in a 35 to 40 minute talk. Population is obviously one of the central issues we face with global warming. The more people there are to admit carbon pollution, all else being equal, the more carbon that is going to be emitted. So it is absolutely an issue. I mean, I think about, I started out as an activist, not on energy and climate. I wasn't thinking about that back then. I started out as an activist on population growth because I got, I don't know how I got it, why I got it. I got a mailing from an organization that at the time was called Zero Population Growth. And that was like, whoa, they're right. And, you know, I've looked at the numbers. When the estimate is that when I was born, and here I'll date myself, 1965, so I have a momentous birthday coming up this year, the world's population was about 3.3 billion people is the estimate. It's now over 7.1 billion. So I've seen the globe's population double just in my own lifetime. That cannot go on forever. That must be addressed. And that addressing it is part of dealing with the climate crisis. Now, anytime you talk about population, you've got to talk about the flip side, because it's not just how many people there are, but it's how much energy and everything else those people use on average. And so we need to face up that even though the U.S. population is not growing terribly fast by global standards, although it is growing fast by industrialized country standards, we use huge amounts of stuff. I mean, in order to sustain the entire world's population at an American average consumption level, we need 4 planets. Anyone know where we can even find one spare? I don't. So, expanding our way of life is not possible. In fact, we need to change our way of life so that we're not using so much stuff, including fossil fuel energy. So yes, absolutely. Population needs to be addressed, even though it makes people uncomfortable to talk about how many children you should have. Nobody wants you to tell them you should not have so many children. And it gets even more complicated when it's mostly white people in industrialized countries saying, you people with more melanin in your skin need to have less children, especially if we're not dealing with our own side of it, the consumption side of it. It makes it look like what we're really saying is, you need to stop having kids so we can keep living the high life. And neither one will solve the problem alone. It has to be addressed together. Yeah.
Thank you, as always, and I, of course, appreciate the fact that I've now heard you give this talk twice, and I admire your consistency. However, for me, there's a fundamental dissonance. There's a bunch of ways to point to it. One is, All this science seems to point to the question of what is progress, our way of life, as if humans had a way of life that was apart from the life on the planet, describing challenges as problems, which is a pure 19th century Newtonian linear engineering industrial age artifact, the process, the fundamental way of thinking that's gotten us where we are. Einstein said, you can't solve a really complicated problem without going outside the way it got created. So I'm John, I'm not hearing reaching outside the way the thinking in terms of progress and growth and the fact that human population is more important than some other population. Where's the forward-looking part of this? Where's the novel innovation? We have to do something not just numerically different, but qualitatively different. Because I think Rachel Carson was the first person in the 50s to talk about the mess we're making for ourselves, not Bill McKibben.
Right. Rachel Carson, though dealing with primarily issues of poisons, not the climate crisis, was far earlier than Bill McKibben was. Again, this goes to the limits of a 35 to 40 minute talk. I touched on it briefly, which was when I talked about the fact that this is fundamentally a religious question that concerns who we are and what is our place as part of the world. And by phrasing it that way, I have telegraphed to you what the answer is. Our place is as part of the world. But our culture lives as if we are masters of the world, that the world is essentially our property. It's ours to decide which species live and which species die. If they're useful to us, they may live. If they're not and they're in the way, more's the pity, but oh well. They weren't useful to us. It's ending this assumption that's thousands and thousands of years old that the world was made for us and we were made to conquer and rule it. It was not, and we are not. We're just one species amongst many, and until we learn to live as if we're just one species among many, no better and no worse than the rest, and until we learn to live as if this is the world that is of prime importance. Perhaps there is an afterlife. I personally don't believe in one, but there may be one. I don't know that there isn't. But regardless, this is the world we should be focused on. Not pie in the sky when we die, as somebody said, and I can't remember who right now. So we have to change our fundamental understanding of the fact that there are limits to growth. We have gone on as if there were no limits to how much of the life-giving capacity of the world we could take for ourselves. And by we, let me clarify, I don't mean all of humanity. I mean our culture, broadly speaking, which encompasses all of global civilization now, but does not encompass all of humanity. There always have been and still are tribal cultures which do not participate in our way of life and do not want to participate in our way of life. They only exist in remote areas of the world that we haven't conquered and destroyed in our pursuit of stuff yet, but they do still exist. We have a lot to learn from them about how to live. So it is, yes, that is the fundamental change in our thinking that we need, and it's fundamentally a religious change in thinking. Yeah, Mike.
John, I wanted to get your opinion on a couple of things I've heard about. It'd be the chilling effect of the NSA monitoring, or maybe not monitoring, but recording speeds, cell phone activities, and computer transmission, and then the possible chilling effect of knowing the FBI is infiltrating some groups to kind of mess with freedom of assembly. Have you experienced any of that or heard anyone who's had to deal with that?
I haven't personally, but of course I've read news stories about it. Frankly, I'd be insulted if I found out I didn't have an FBI file, but I don't know one way or the other. I'm actually less worried about that than I am worried about the the corporate efforts that have been revealed recently. It was in the past 2-3 months. I forget when it was. This tape, I think it was a tape, was leaked of this oil and gas industry conference at which this consultant came in. He was essentially selling his services for this campaign where they would do everything to try to discredit activists that are working on these issues by finding out incriminating, embarrassing information from their private lives and either threatening or releasing that information. The folks that are making tons of money off of this stuff are the ones. That's what really makes them a rogue industry, apart from that thing we just heard about, is that not only are they profiting from wrecking the world, but they're taking a small portion, but still plenty, of their immense obscene profits and using it through these think tanks and these fake grassroots organizations to keep the public, the general public, thinking that we don't know enough to act yet. That's what really makes them a rogue industry. Yes, Carolyn.
Students and other young people have been a very vital part of some movements. Could you comment about how much involvement there is and how to encourage more than there is?
Yeah, absolutely true. Students typically are major forces in social change movements. I don't remember what the current number is, but there are divestment campaigns at many universities across the United States and around the world. And students, young people, are very active in the rallies and the protests. Students are somewhat less inclined to risk arrest, generally speaking, because they're looking out at the prospect of still needing to find work at some point, and that doesn't necessarily make you very employable if you get arrested, which is why we need more of you retired or independently wealthy people to get out with us. But absolutely, students are involved in this. I wish I remembered the number right now about the number of divestment campaigns at universities, but I don't. But it is a big part of this movement. Students are a big part of this movement. Yes?
Bill Moyers recently did an interview with an environmental lawyer who is involved with a movement called the Children's Crusade. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone else happened to see that interview, but this is based on the legal doctrine that the state, the government, holds the responsibility for the environment in trust for future generations. And there are groups of high school students and college students around the country who have sued local and state governments for betraying that trust. Are you familiar at all with the
Children's Crusade? I haven't seen the Bill Moyers episode, sadly. He's now off the air, but I haven't seen that episode yet. But I did read a little bit about it, and I'd heard previously about that. That is another essential aspect of this, because we need to be thinking about that. The greatest responsibility of every generation is to bequeath a better world to the next generation than the one we inherited from our parents. And we are failing immensely at that.
Thank you very much, John.
You just heard a lecture by John Kerman, Why Climate Matters Most and Why We Need You. This week's show was recorded on Sunday, January 11th, 2015, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. A special thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help each week in producing this program. The theme song you are hearing at the beginning and ending of this show is a special theme composed especially for the All Souls Forum by Kansas City composer, pianist Fred Potter. You can find the All Souls Forums in podcast form on KKFI's website at www.kkfi.org. You can find the podcast in the index, which is easily accessible from our website. Again, that's at www.kkfi.org. And there are a number of All Souls broadcasts. They're complete, just for your listening pleasure. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.